Hello, hello there. My name is Maury with my co-host Corey. We are The Real Guys, and this is The Real Show with two E's. The spice must flow, and today it is a very highly anticipated episode for the both of us.
Yes.
But as always, I'm currently my co-host Corey. How are you doing today, Corey?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
And of course, you can always watch this on our video version on The Real Show YouTube channel, The Real Show, Real with two E's, or you could listen to us on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, we are there too. Corey.
Yes.
About a month ago,
correct.
I don't know, a few weeks ago, I went to the cinema.
You did?
And I watched Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2.
Correct.
One of the hottest sci-fi properties at the moment.
It is indeed.
And you have invested several days or perhaps a week of time into reading the original Frank Herbert 1965 Dune novel.
Correct.
All of it.
Took me about a week.
Cover to cover.
Cover to cover. The only thing I haven't read is the appendices.
Oh, great.
And the random, like, word translations.
Oh, yes, the word translations. They're important as well. Yeah. The glossary of word translations.
But I have read it back to back, and I very much enjoyed it. In preparation for 2021's Dune Part 1.
Yes, Dune Part 1, which we will be reviewing today. And speaking about the story and changes from the book, trivia, all that kind of fun stuff is up today. So, Corey.
Hello.
Let's talk about the book.
Okay.
Let's talk about 1965's. Your impressions of the book. I know this isn't turning into the book show where we talk about books.
Yeah.
But I just want to know, Corey, what was your impressions from when you started to when you ended?
So when I bought Dune, I bought it on a whim off of the great Amazon. Other bookstores are available.
How much was it? Yeah, other bookstores
£8.
Are available. £8. Do you think it could have been less?
You know what? For a paperback that size, I'm fine with that, especially because obviously a film coming out.
Yeah, they're very popular. Yeah, bring the price up.
I didn't realize how big it was until it arrived.
Yes,
and it came like that.
It is hefty.
And I was like, I was like, right, I've got like a week to read it before we record the show. I can do that. And then it came with all 550 pages of it, and I was like, right, okay, a bit more of a challenge. But when I was reading it, I was like, actually, you know what? This is it. I'm not a big sci-fi guy. I think that's the first sci-fi book I've read. And it gripped me straight away. And I was very much hooked. And I read it and I loved it. Thought it was fantastic. Thought it was great. Big old space opera.
Yes.
Is the best way to describe it.
Massive space opera. We start with Duke Leto Atreides.
Exactly.
Of House Atreides on the ocean world of Caladan.
Very nice place.
And yes, beautiful world,
lovely
Caladan.
Place.
And of course, we are in 10,091,
something like that.
191, something like AD, something like that.
Yeah.
And humanity has journeyed to the stars, and three things are important. One is drugs.
Yes, spice.
Everyone's on spice.
Everyone loves spice.
Or Sappho, or everyone is on some kind of drug.
Yeah.
Two, space politics are very important.
Very important.
There are three powers in the known universe. One of them is the Bene Gesserit, which is the order of witches that control, that sort of advise the lords and dukes and secretly control the politics and the inner breeding of all the houses.
Hello, Jessica.
Two, there is the Spacing Guild.
Correct.
Who control transport and ferrying products and everything like that.
And their giant fishing tanks.
Yep, and their giant, the guild navigators. Who take lots of spice into tanks and whatnot and transform into fishmen. I love them. And with them is sort of the Chome Company, which isn't mentioned in the film, but is mentioned in the book.
It's mentioned in the book.
Chome Company are
quite
kind of like the stock of sort of the universe and how sort of different stocks on different days could change the ownership of a whole planet to another house or something like that. You know? And every family has a stake in Chome, right? And then there is the power of the Emperor, the imperial power of the Carino Empire. Since the Battle of Corin, the Carino Empire is ruled now under current Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV.
Correct. And you know what? The thing, so when I started reading it, I realised very quickly that this is going to be a book that's very heavy on lore and characters.
And you understand why I like it so much.
Yeah, which it normally is not my thing. Mm. I tend to get lost when there's loads of names. I'm like, who is it? Who is it? I can't remember who they are. Thankfully.
Who's talking? Who's there?
I found that quite easy.
Oh, God, I'm glad. Me
to be
too.
Like, ah, yes, that's Gurney. I know Howard. I know who that is. I know you. Cool, great.
I know who fear what.
Yeah.
I know all the names.
I know Rabban.
I know Rabban.
Hello,
yeah.
Rabban.
Glossy Rabban. Love him. But let's also talk about the Butlerian Jihad has also taken place previously.
Yep.
The Butlerian Holy War was taken where all of the AI, all of the computers, all the robots were destroyed.
Yes.
And the Orient Catholic Bible says, thou shalt not make a machine in likeness to a man's mind.
Yep.
And so all of the machines were destroyed, which relies upon the Spacing Guild navigators and Mentats.
Now we've got Mentats.
Who are human computers.
Yeah.
And they take the drug Sappho. Well, not in the film, but in the book they take Sappho.
We do. Got like red lips.
Yeah, red lips. And in the film they have a little black tattoo.
Got a little like black mark on the lip.
Black mark on their lip, which tells you they're Mentats. And these are human computers that are able to sort of calculate and think strategy and things like that. So on the world of Caladan, there is House Atreides. And we've got the Duke Leto,
correct.
His son, Paul Atreides, and
hello,
his
Paul.
Concubine, Jessica,
yes.
Who is a Bene Gesserit.
Correct.
And we'll just set up the story in a minute. And the arch-rival of House Atreides
are the Harkonnens.
The Harkonnens, House Harkonnen,
yes.
Led by the Baron, Vladimir Harkonnen.
Yep. Big man.
Big. He's huge.
Has suspenders, the straps.
No. Suspensive technology, which allows him to float above. And he's very different in the film to the...
He's very different in the film to the books.
In the film, it's... Well, let me describe film version. Then maybe you can give me an essence of book version. Film version, Stellan Skarsgård, amazing performance.
Really good performance.
Prosthetics, big fat suit. Doesn't say much. Very lot of silent terror. Yeah. A lot of like a strong image. You've got to have that strong image, so of course you don't have to talk too much. And he doesn't say a lot, but he sort of sits there very silently. You know, he's still got the big loves for food. Loves, oh, you have a beautiful kitchen, cousin. Oh. The Emperor's a jealous man. And then the music goes, like that, you know.
Nice.
Wee! Like that. That's the how the music goes. And he controls the House Harkonnen, the Baron, from the planet Giedi Prime. And he's very different because he's... You know, the Harkonnen image of the Denis Villeneuve films are like bold, pale, quite alien, sort of humanoid figures. Whereas in the book, the Baron is quite chatty.
He talks quite a bit.
Yeah.
Very more kind of clever, very smart.
Yeah, grand speeches.
Loves to plan things out. Mm. And also loves telling everyone around him exactly what his plan is.
Yeah, all of his plans.
What he's doing.
He's a deviant. He's a bit of a creepy guy. He's creeping around, and he's big. You can see him coming, and he's got this sort of. He's got a control of House Harkonnen, where it's his authority, the Baron's authority.
Yeah.
But and then below him we have, of course, Fade Rautha, who isn't in this first film. He's in part two, played by Austin Butler. Amazing, fantastic performance. But Fade Rautha in the book is tell us a bit about old Fade.
Fade is essentially the young nephew, younger than the Baron, who is kind of the like. He's like a gladiatorial fighter, fights in the pit all the time, bit of a showman, talks to the ladies a lot, not allowed to do that, can't do that. And he's essentially the Baron's like next pick for the heir.
Yes.
He wants him to rule, and he wants the Baron to take the fall for it.
On the other side, we have Glossu Rabban.
Yeah.
Poor Rabban, who is a muscle-minded tank brain, as he is referred to.
And that's pretty much all it is in the book.
Yeah, he's just a brute force character. He's not actually in as much as the book.
No, he's not.
No. He only appears, I think, after... the Atreides attack on...
Yeah.
Sorry, no, the Harkonnen attack on the Atreides city, Arrakeen, I think a Rabban appears.
I think his first time he appears is when he's told, like, oh, you need to, like...
Go to...
Clamp down, get the spice, get the money.
Yeah, on Arrakis, yeah. Squeeze Rabban, squeeze hard, as the Baron says.
And that's pretty much it.
And in the film, he's played by, not friend of the show, but common topic of the show, Dave the Animal Batista.
Correct.
And I think it's funny that Rabban's nickname is the Beast Rabban. I've played by the Animal Batista.
Which, in all fairness, I would describe Batista as very muscly.
Yeah, yeah.
It fits.
He could well be Rabban.
Rabban.
Yeah. He does it great. He does a great job.
So on that point, very good casting.
Yeah, very good casting. And good for Dave Batista. Good. Whenever he can find work, I'm always happy.
Because
I think he's a fantastic actor. However, the Padishah Emperor, Shaddam IV, has told the House Atreides to leave their world of
Caladan
and go to Arrakis.
Yep.
Arrakis, a world beyond cruelty, the sand world where the famous spice is produced, by which the whole universe relies.
Yep, everyone loves spice.
Everyone runs on the spice. So the Bene Gesserit have mysterious political aims, and they wield physical and mental abilities such as the Weirding Way, fight in the Weirding Way, and to control their bodies on the cellular level, even to determine the gender of their child, the sex of
Correct.
The child.
Because Paul was meant to be a daughter.
So they could breed this Atreides' daughter with Fade
yep.
and create the Kwisatz Haderach,
yes.
which is the sort of the ultimate mind power.
Yeah, he can like go into men's minds as well as women's minds, essentially.
And the Duke Leto is with his aide, the famous fighter Duncan Idaho.
Yep.
Who is a proud man of the Atreides house, an elite soldier.
He is.
And Gurney Halleck.
Yes.
You know about Gurney, played by Josh Brolin in the film.
Who is my favourite character in the book.
Yes. Well, with good reason. Because Gurney's a poet, Gurney's a singer.
Yeah, does playing the Ballastet.
Yeah, plays the Ballastet. And
which, again,
he's
spoilers.
He's also the finest, one of the finest fighters in the Imperium. He's one of the best swordsmen.
No, it didn't happen in the 1984 film, and it didn't happen in this, but apparently it was the deleted scene. Why does no one let him play the Ballastet in the films?
Yeah, he carries it around in the 1980s, 84 version.
Apparently there is a deleted scene in part one where he does play it.
Yeah, because there's an image of him with it. There's an image picture of him with it, and Paul says, you know, sing us a song, Gurney, and stuff like that.
I will say this, though. As much as a good job Gurney is in doing part one, I think I still prefer Patrick Stewart.
Do you?
Yeah.
I will always remember that famous Patrick Stewart line of, I think I've said this in the last Dune review, on which I liked it, and I think I've said this to you without else even being recording, that my favourite line in Dune in 1984 is when Gurney wants to train with him with the shields.
I think I know exactly what you're going to say.
Paul says, I'm not in the mood, Gurney. And Patrick Stewart stops. He goes, mood? Mood for cattle and love play. And I go, yes, Gurney, that's the line, Gurney.
Yeah.
I don't know, is that in the, I can't remember if
it
that's
is
in the book. Yeah, I knew it was. I was about to ask if it was in the book or not. And of course, Duncan Idaho in Dune Part 1, Denis Villeneuve Dune, is played by the ever amazing Jason Momoa.
Yep. Who is, I mean, again, he fits.
Yeah,
he's really, a big, strong.
Big, strong warrior. You could believe him being an expert fighter. And Thuthir Hawat, who is the Duke's mentat assistant. And then who should arrive to Caladan before they leave, but the Reverend Mother Gaius Mahayam, who is the leader of the Bene Gesserits. And she subjects Paul to the deadly test of the Gomjabar.
The Gomjabar test.
Which is, describe to me the test.
So, you're in this room, right? Imagine this. You're one-on-one with a Reverend Mother. You sat down, right? And there's a box. Ominous box. It's a normal black box. Yeah. It's a little black box.
Holy.
And she's like, oh yeah, just put your hand in the box. It's like I'm a celeb or something, you know. What's on the other side? What's it going to be? So you put your hand in, and then all of a sudden she just pulls out this needle and goes, right, you can't move now.
Can't move now, the killing needle.
If you move, you get poisoned.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well, what's in the box? And she just goes, pain.
Yes.
And essentially, the test is, your hand will start to hurt.
Yes.
A lot. If you pull your hand out, you are an animal and you die.
Dine, yes.
If you don't pull your hand out, you are human and you live. That is the test.
You must endure the pain, but he takes his hand out and his hand's fine.
It's completely fine.
No.
No burns, no nothing. Scratches, nothing. Completely fine. It's all in the mind. It thinks like little like things under the fingers that do something to the nerves or something.
You
I can't remember.
Not fear. Fear is the mind killer.
Yes, that gets said a lot in the book.
Yes, fear is the little death which breeds a total obliteration. No, that one. That's a very famous passage of the book. So they travelled to occupy Arrakis, and the Harkonnens have been there for, I think, 80 years, something like that, and they've been mining it relentlessly to become very wealthy.
Yep.
So the Atreides arrive and the Harkonnens leave, and then Leto learns that the dangers involved in harvesting spice, not only are the spice fields very treacherous, but also patrolled by the giant sandworms.
Gross sandworms.
Shai Hulud, as they are known to the indigenous Fremen people.
Big old worms.
Big old worms. And the worms actually make the spice. It is their secretion.
Yes.
They secrete spice, and it is harvested by the spice harvesters.
Yep.
And what's the ways to get around on Arrakis if you're not...
Well, you've got a couple ways to go around. If you're part of a Fremen, which we'll get onto at some point, they're a big part of the film and book.
You can ride a worm.
You can ride a worm. And if you're very, very skilled, you can do the sand walk.
The sand walk.
Which involves steps and like sweeping
walk without
feet
rhythm,
motions.
You won't attract the worm.
Yep.
You've got to sweep, you've got to flick, you've got to just sweep your feet around.
And
so as to mimic the natural motion of the sand.
Of the sand, exactly.
Because the worms are drawn by
rhythm.
By rhythm.
That's why you don't want to walk normally.
No.
And you don't want to go near drum sand.
No. And why the Fremen use
thumpers
to draw the worms. And if you're not a Fremen, you're not riding around on a worm.
Nope.
You could perhaps jump into an ornithopter.
You can jump into a big old ornithopter or a small ornithopter.
Mm-hmm.
There's different kinds.
Yeah, there are different kinds.
Which they do. Leto does.
You could jump into an ornithopter and fly around. Love those devices. Great transport.
Very cool looking.
Yeah, very cool looking.
I do like them. Very nice.
And with them on Arrakis is the Sook Doctor Wellington Yue.
Yep.
Who is a trained Sook Doctor of the Sook Order, to not betray
He's been trained.
He's conditioned.
You can't betray anyone. He's strong-minded.
So he is. And with on the Baron's side as well, we've got to mention the Pyter de Vries, who's not mentioned before.
Who's the Duke's, not Duke's Mentat, he's the Baron's Mentat.
The Baron's Mentat, Pyter de Vries, he is a Mentat, a twisted Mentat assassin.
Yep.
And he uses the Sappho to give thoughts a quiet speed.
And he's a very weird one indeed.
Yes, he is.
Because in the Baron's plans...
I know what he's like in the book.
Yeah, he's like, in the book, he's very much like, when you get the Duke, I want his wife, himself. He's very just like, just weirdy, twisted man. Which, spoilers for the book and the film, is fine. Doesn't last very long.
No, Pyter doesn't go very long. No, Pyter doesn't go very long. But a couple of characters that are also involved in the story are Fenring, Lady Margot Fenring, who is a Mentat. I'm sorry, not Mentat, that's her husband, who is a Bene Gesserit.
Yes.
And her husband, who is the Count Hasimir Fenring, who is a Mentat. A Mentat Count. And a former... a failed Kwisatz Haderach, as they say.
Yes.
Because the Bene Gesserit have a breeding program to basically breed the Kwisatz Haderach, and Fenring was he could have been, basically. Could have been the Kwisatz Haderach. So. And he takes control of Caladan when the Atreides leave, because they do make them just basically pack up everything to Arrakis. Because the Emperor's plan is, and is revealed in the film, the surprise attack by the Harkonnen.
Yep.
How will the Emperor and the Harkonnens plot this surprise attack?
Well, in the film, you get no inclination pretty much whatsoever that anything's wrong, for the most part. In the book, it's a bit different. In the book, you spend most of the first part of the book knowing that Yue is a traitor, and at some point is going to backstab a whole family because he thinks, his wife is dead, but he wants to kill the Baron himself and end everything. In the film, it isn't the case. You just find out eventually that Yue's the traitor.
Yue's betrayed them,
And then off of that, you're going to get the Sardaukar are going to come in.
Yes.
So the big old forces, which in the book are dressed like Harkonnen men.
They are. I was going to mention that.
In the film, they are not.
They are different. They are white armoured soldiers, whereas the Harkonnens are in black.
Yeah.
But in the book, to cover up the Emperor's involvement, the Sardaukar are made to dress like Harkonnen men.
Yes. Which is one thing that, for me, the film is a little bit lacking on.
Yeah, I did like that book. That's one of my favourite things in the book.
There's a lot of bits in the book where, like, because it's so
strategy,
big,
because it's so, thick.
There's, like, a lot of, like, information that you just kind of get, like, inward thoughts and just little bits.
It's a lot of thinking. It's a lot of... That's why Dune is often said to be unadaptable, because it's a lot of interior monologue.
Yeah.
It's a lot of... inner people's thoughts.
Which they try.
And questions and considerers.
And they do an... I would say they do an alright job of it.
Yeah.
Because you can't just have, like, Timothy Chalamet sat there.
No.
For, like, 2 minutes.
In a monologue, thinking about something or whatever.
And then cut to Jessica. And her in a monologue.
And she's doing something as well. And the... Yeah.
You couldn't have that.
And the inner monologue. No. But the Sardaukar, who are the Emperor's terror troops, his finest forces on the planet Seleucus Secundus.
Yep.
And... they're brought over to fight the Atreides.
Whenever you say that scene, I just get the scene from the film in my head.
What? The guy's chanting.
Just kind of stood in this, like, thing.
It's like he's got a tie around his head. It's like...
which doesn't happen in the book.
But that's such an aesthetic thing. I can tell it's funny. It's such an aesthetic thing. And all the soldiers are all lined up, and it's like... bodies that are upside down, and they're bleeding into the water, and they're using the water to, like, baptize the soldiers. And I'm like, that level of, that's great. But, yes, and because the Baron has a deal with the Emperor, to where he will vacate Arrakis to allow the Kratos to occupy it, and then all of the Harkonnen money that's gone from mining the spice will go into basically buying the transport and buying all these troops to... finally exterminate the Atreides house because they're becoming too popular in the Landsrat.
Exactly. The Harkonnens don't like them.
No, they could threaten the power of the Emperor because the Landsrat is like Parliament.
Yep.
And it challenges the power of the Emperor. So the Emperor has to carefully deal with the Landsraad, but to bypass their great houses of the Landsraad, they could just get rid of the Atreides.
Yeah. Which, for the most part, straight away.
Goes pretty well. They take out Arakeen. Yeah, they occupy Arakeen. And Rabban is told to basically continue with spice production as normal. And for obviously, the whole other part of the book is a whole other film.
Yeah.
It stops halfway, I think, something like that.
Yeah, and the film stops about halfway in the book.
And then carries on to say, well, the rest of this happened.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, Stilgar, who is the leader of the Fremen Siege.
Yep.
And the Siege is where all the Fremen hide out. And he becomes very enamoured with Paul, who joins the Fremen. Goes into the desert, escapes with his mother.
Yep.
And goes into the desert to join the Fremen. And, of course, Chaney, who is also there, and who is a sort of Fremen woman and a friend and a later concubine to Paul.
Yep.
Especially in part two, this is a slight spoiler for part two.
Yeah.
She is very much against the Kwisatz Haderach and the Lisan al Ghaib prophecy.
Yes.
She believes that it will enslave the Fremen to another master, like the Harkonnens, and will be no different, basically. Yeah. Whereas in the book, she is not. She goes along with Paul.
Yeah.
Paul himself in the book is very passive to say that. I'm sure you wouldn't doubt me saying that. But I remember Book Paul being just like letting things happen to him.
Book Paul is very much that case
everyone around him's doing stuff.
Yeah. Until at some point it does switch where he's like, I am this thing now. I am what they say I am. I'm not the Kwisatz Haderach. And then about 100 pages later, he goes, actually, yeah, I am.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I am.
And then he just gets this like massive god complex.
Yeah, well, they say that he is the Lisan al Ghaib, which is the voice from the outer world.
Yeah.
Basically, the Bene Gesserit, in their missionary work, has planted seeds of a prophecy and sprinkled it, just like a fine sprinkling of salt, on Arrakis, and made all of the native Arrakeen people believe that this voice from the outer world will come and will save them and will deliver them to paradise or whatever.
Yeah.
However, Paul's been having some visions. He's got a power called prescience.
Yep.
Do you know what prescience is?
Go on, explain.
I thought you were going to explain. You've read the book.
I have read the book. I don't know if it's been... It probably did get mentioned. I probably glossed over that.
Prescience must have been mentioned at some point. It's the ability to see the future.
Right.
It's the ability to...
It would have got mentioned. I probably forgot that's what it was called.
Okay.
I was like, I was having a vision again.
Yeah. Paul's having visions. Well, visions of prescience. And he sees things. And he sees the future. He sees himself leading this... the Atreides Jihad, leading the Holy War, which wipes out billions and billions of people. And he doesn't want to end up doing it.
Nope.
And then he ends up doing it.
Yeah.
Because Paul is not the good guy.
No.
And none of these characters are, really.
No.
Were you sort of shocked at
how
grey this book is? How grey Dune is in
content? I wouldn't say I was shocked. So, obviously, I started off and I was like, right, okay, I'm getting the Atreides. Harkonnens are obviously the big bad. I want to try and like screw these guys over and whatever. And like I say, when it got to about the halfway point where Paul kind of starts getting this bit of like a god complex and he's like, actually, I am this thing. I'm unstoppable. I could fight Stilgar and I would best him. Everyone knows I would.
Yeah.
I'm like, right, okay, you're changing a bit here. And then right about the end of the book, when he's like, we're just going to go attack these people now.
Yeah.
And just like bend them at my will. I'm like, right, okay. It's like, right. This is where this is going. But it's good. Because some people probably read that and go, I agree with what he's doing. Some people probably go, actually, maybe not now.
Maybe
the Harkonnens were still bad, but not as bad. What is happening right now.
What's happening right now is arguably worse.
He is arguably worse. He has his moments.
Yeah, to lead a massive holy war to wipe out all the great houses and all the planets in the service of him being the Kwisatz Haderach Lisan al Ghaib.
Definitely got a bit of a power complex.
Yes. But it happens in there is the final duel between Fade Rautha and Paul Atreides to determine the fate, because the Emperor decides to rock up. He sees Emperor Shaddam and his daughter Irulan, the princess, arrives as well. He's got four children. I don't know what they're all. I know two of them.
Yeah.
I know one's called Wenensia, and one of them's called Irulan. I know there's also two of them who are likewise named as well. And he's got like a nephew or a grandson.
I think so.
That's in the story as well. And yeah, the book is very expansive that way, and it's full of lore and character and different people and different motives. It's plans within plans, as Frank Herbert writes. And he's a very skilled writer for his time, especially 1965. And as progressive a writer as Frank Herbert is, and the amount of, you know, his wording and his depth of knowledge of the mind and mm-hmm. and thoughts and inner monologue of people is just fantastic. The way that the story is crafted.
Yeah, it's definitely really good, especially from the fact of in terms of sci-fi and books and genres, it was a massive kind of pivotal thing. Even on the back of the book that I've got, it mentions this before The Matrix, before Star Wars, before Ender's Game, there was Dune.
Well, because this is such a massive influence on basically every single sci-fi thing ever made, that Dune was a sort of founder of the sci-fi genre itself, basically. Yep. That there are parts of Dune in sort of every sci-fi property ever because of how influential it was and at its time, how much influence it had over everyone. You know, there's parts of Dune in every sci-fi, I think, in some way. Even the ones being created today. Even some people say that, you know, even the media that's coming out today, like Rebel Moon, as by Zack Snyder, as parts of Dune in it.
Yep.
And, you know, Star Wars has big influences, Dune.
Yep.
And the other one that you said, Matrix or something
like that. Matrix was on that, yeah.
And there's parts of Dune of, you know, the mind and visions and all of that kind of thing. Because that was Frank Herbert's big philosophy.
Yep.
To kind of open the mind to people, right? To stop relying on technology and the thinking machines, as he writes, and to sort of open your mind. Perhaps not with the use of recreational drugs.
No.
As, you know, Frank Herbert just says, yeah, the drug, everyone else on drugs. You know, everyone's on spice. And I think even back to Peter DeVries, I think he takes spice as well as Sappho.
Probably.
That's why the Baron sort of keeps him in line.
Yeah.
Because they need to have Arrakis to make spice that way or something like that. And, you know, the guild navigators greatly require it.
Yep.
And especially transport things around the universe because nothing moves without the guild.
Yeah.
And the guild need their spice for their navigators and for their sort of hayliners.
Yes.
Because they travel by way of the Holtzman effect, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yep. And it's also mentioned in the book, that's why the worms exist, because they can't get rid of them.
Mm.
It's also mentioned in the book right near the end, but Paul's going to go, actually, I can get rid of this.
Yeah,
and just eliminate all of it. Because that's easy, apparently.
And the Holtzman effect works via folding space, which I'm sure was described to you in the book.
Maybe.
Did it talk about folding space?
Possibly.
Basically how the navigator doesn't actually fly the ship, but he basically just says to go from one point to another and to avoid all like things like suns and stars
right.
and collapsing nebulas and things like that and all the hazards of space travel, the navigator can use his prescience to see into the future, to see where they should be going, and then go that way, and then the Holtzman, you know, the steersman, the guild steersman, will put the course to the Holtzman generator and then it will go.
Yep.
So it's not like they don't have a navigation system. They don't have like a computer that does it. It's done for the mind. It's done within the mind.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're on spice yourself, like the Fremen, you will have the...
You've got blue eyes.
The eyes of Ibad, as it's called.
Yep.
Which are the distinctive blue eyes of the Fremen.
Yes. Which later on, well, at least in the book, I'm assuming in Dune Part 2, Paul gets them.
Yes, because of the Water of Life,
yep.
as it's described. Do you know what the Water of Life is?
That's what he takes in the book to test if he is the Inquisitor Haderach, I believe.
That's Haderach, yes.
Because he's like, oh, he's in like a coma for 3 weeks, and they think he's poisoned. And then he wakes up, and he's like, I drank the water.
You have to drown a baby worm.
Yeah.
You have to take a baby sandworm and then drown it, and then the bile it comes up with is this blue liquid,
yep.
which is known as the Water of Life. And everything is based around the worms. For the
yes, it's a lot of worms.
Everything is based around Shai Halud. Even the weaponry.
Yeah.
Because the Chris...
Good old Chris knife.
You know what the good old Chris knife is? It's the tooth
like
of...
The tooth.
Of the, it's a maker,
yeah.
as they say. Because the maker of spice is the worm, and the worm has a tooth, and the tooth knife, the Chris knife, that stuff like that. And to prove, I'm getting the hiccups. And to prove himself, it's all the spice I've been taking.
Some spice. You're going to get blue eyes in a minute.
Yeah, exactly. I'm drinking Sappho. It's to do with his first test as to become the Fremen is to fight Jamis, the man who, you know, Jamis, the popular Fremen.
Yeah, he, what's it called? It's the test he says, oh, I'm reciting the, I can't remember what it is. When he challenges Paul, he's like, oh, I'm, he does for the fight's got a name. He calls it something.
The fight's got a name. I'm blanking on this too. I kind of don't know what the fight's called. You have to look that up.
I am looking it up.
Okay. I'll talk about it while you do that.
You do it.
Because Jessica knows the weirding way, and she schools the Fremen, and Stilgar's like, no, one man must fight. You know, he must fight his own battle. So Paul engages in this duel with Jamis, given the Chris knife, because Jessica already has a Chris knife.
Yes.
She was given one by Mapes, who is a Fremen housekeeper, who gives her a Chris knife, and then Chani gives Paul a Chris knife.
He does indeed.
So Paul can engage in two... There's two sort of very similar duels to the point where in the film, the Atreides salute, which is, you know, across the chest and up here.
Yep.
He does the Atreides salute there, and he does it in the final duel as well, because that's what Duncan did before he sacrificed himself to the oncoming forces of the Sardaukar and to defeat them in combat. Because, and also, they don't use shields in the desert of Arrakis, because the shields will drive the worms into a frenzy. The shields, as it vibrates, and it makes the worms very angry. So instead, they look to using sort of more unarmed combat, swords, knives, and all that kind of thing, flipping, jumping, running, everything. The Fremen are very agile folk. So the Harkonnens quickly realise this. They don't have any shields, they don't have any protection.
Nope.
So they end up just using regular firearms and regular guns, not las guns or anything, just projectile weapons. And I believe the Harkonnen attack on the Atreides is done with just cannons and regular...
Yeah, I believe
just
so.
Just guns and weapons.
Yeah.
And nothing that's like, not a las gun, any something like that, because just things that are old, because it's done with artillery, because... The Atreides, the shield wall is taken down, and they can't use shields on Arrakis.
Nope.
So it was basically set. Everything was set up for the Harkonnens to basically just steal all of the Atreides and take back control of Arrakis again. Yep. Have you found the name of the duel?
No.
Okay.
I'm still trying to find it.
I can only talk for so long, Corey. You must search quickly. Why don't you search Paul Atreides Jamis duel?
That's what I've looked up.
Oh, all right. Or maybe just look at the plot of Dune. And then go to the bit where...
Amtal rule.
What?
The Amtal rule.
Right, and what is that?
The Amtal rule is a tenet on a primitive world under which something is tested to determine its limits or defects. So essentially he went, I'm going to ingest the rule because I want to test if Paul is actually what he says it is.
Okay.
And he finds out that he is because he beats him.
Yes. He beats him. Yes, he does. And... He beats him quite handily.
He does beat him quite handily.
And then he goes on to fight Fade Rautha.
He does. And I think he's toying with Jamis because he's got numerous times to win.
To win, and he
doesn't do it.
No, because he's never killed a man before.
Because he's never killed a man, and he's not used to having no shields.
Yes, he's good at fighting, but he's not good at fighting with no shields.
So he gets an opening, and he moves slow. And he's too slow.
What's the rule with a shield?
Well, when you're fighting with a shield, you see, if you had a shield on and I just struck normally, it would just deflect.
Yep.
Wouldn't go through.
No.
You'd have to slowly penetrate the shield to get to your victim.
Yes, the slow blade penetrates the shield, as they say. Or in the 1984 version, where they were jumping around in orange boxes. Donk, 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 donk.
The shields in that were...
The shields in the Denis Villeneuve are better, because it's just like a blue glow.
They are better, yes.
You only see it when they're hitting each
other. When they're hitting each other, and blue is a deflect, red is a hit.
Red's
great,
a hit,
cool.
Yeah. And when the Sardaukar attack, you notice in the film, that they look like they're cutting fast, but they're mowing people down because the shields are all going red whenever they strike.
Yes.
So it's like they must be so good that it looks fast, but the initial
they can,
the blade
slow it down.
Cut, yeah, but the blade cut is slow. So when they come in with the high strike and they go, there's that one guy that does it like Deathstroke, and... No, he does. When they're fighting up the stairs, the Atreides guys are like, Atreides, Atreides. And they're fighting together on the stairs with the shields and swords. And the Harkonnens going up. The Sardaukar come out of that landing craft. And they land on the... They, like, hover downwards. And they do, like, they have a big fight. And the Harkonnen soldiers are having a bit of a tough time with the Atreides. But the Sardaukar take, like, 5 seconds to wipe out all these dudes. And they're just like... And all the shields just going down. And all the guys drop. And then the Sardaukar just keep walking. And I like that. That's how you portray... A threatening enemy, but also a threatening enemy is the Baron, and who ends up dealing with the Baron in the book?
So the Baron in the book is dealt with by Paul's daughter, but it has Bachani. I forgot her name. It begins with an A.
It's Alia.
Yeah.
I think you mean Paul's sister.
That's it. Sorry, Paul's sister, Jessica's daughter.
Yes, Jessica's daughter.
Because she has a daughter with Leto, right? he doesn't know about.
Yeah.
Never finds out about. No.
And he dies.
Leto dies. The daughter is born after...
She's 3 years old at that point, I think so.
Yeah. Jessica goes through, like, training to become the Reverend Mother.
Yeah.
And then because of that...
Of the Fremen.
The daughter then kind of essentially gets all of the memories from the other Reverend Mummers.
And so the even though life.
Yeah. So even though she's like young, she knows like everything.
Yeah.
So she essentially tricks the Baron by going to where he is, getting captured, going to him, and just poisons him.
Uses the Gomjabo.
Yep. And just poisons him.
Yeah, just like, uses him.
Done.
Yeah. They are the Baron's
quick.
Out. Baron's out. And then the Emperor's like, goodness me, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You've really let this go, haven't you? And then he brings all of his dudes, and they start to have the final fight for the fate of Arrakis.
Yep.
And it's Paul. Count Hasimir Fenrig is up there, and he's like, no, mate, no. I'm not going to do that. You know, whatever.
No. At that point, Howard is gone. He was poisoned by the Baron.
Yeah.
He was given him poison, and in his food was the antidote. Yep. And as soon as he left, he would end up dying anyway. But I think Howard just ends up poisoning himself anyway, before he ends up going naturally by that. Sorry for Batista fans.
Yep, sorry for Raban.
He dies off screen.
Yeah, he does. We don't even see what happened to him.
I don't know what happens to him.
No, no. Well, no, in part two, in the film.
I'm assuming in the film, he has a bigger role.
He has a bigger role, and Gurney, because Gurney got that scar Gurney on got his the face scar from Raban, because he was a slave of Raban.
Yes.
We know that in part two, and there's a big fight at the end when the Emperor's complex is attacked, and Gurney gets to have a final duel with Raban and slays him then.
Which
spoilers.
Has not happened in the book.
No.
Gurney, I don't think, even mentions the fact that Raban gets killed.
No, no.
Says nothing.
No.
All he says is he wants to fight Fade, and...
Gurney does step up.
Paul's like, no, I'll do it.
Yeah, Paul's like, no, I'll do it, yeah.
Fade dies at the end of the book.
He does, yeah.
Everyone is gone, essentially.
Yeah. He sends everyone away. The Emperor and Count Asimir Fenrig and everything are all sent on to Seleucus Secundus to be imprisoned there.
Paul is now...
Family. And Paul is now the Emperor.
Firmly...
He is now firmly the Kwisatz Haderach.
In the hot seat.
And, launches his Bring Everyone to Paradise.
Pretty much.
Quest. To
I'm sure.
Wipe out billions of people.
I'm sure in Dune Messiah and Children of a Dune goes
path.
Great.
Yes. Well, what happened here? Let me tell you what happened. In 1965, everyone read this book and thought, Paul must be the hero.
Yeah.
Paul defeats the evil emperor and the big fat baron and becomes the hero.
Of course.
And then Frank Herbert says, no, I didn't write that. I wrote him as, using the prophecy to his own end and becoming mad with power and causing a holy war which kills billions of people. Let me write Doom Messiah so you know how it's actually supposed to go. And Denis Villeneuve have said that he would do Doom Messiah if it's better than Doom Part 2, which is a very hard ask because...
I've not seen Doom Part 2. As soon as it probably comes on anything, I'll probably give it a watch at this point. Now I've read the book as well, especially. Mostly, to one, I enjoyed the first film. We'll get onto the rating at some point. I enjoyed the first film. And also, I wanted to keep seeing how it differs from the book a bit now.
Do you have Messiah?
I do not yet.
Will you be getting
Messiah? I will be getting Messiah. Will I read it straight after this? I don't know. But it will be read at some point this year. I want to read the trilogy by the end of the year. So the first three.
Yep.
But I've heard the fourth one is apparently like... pretty much the best
Children.
One.
Is that God Emperor?
It's God Emperor.
God Emperor, okay.
I've heard that's the best, so I'm like, do I stretch it to four? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that'll be sprinkled along. Maybe if Doom Messiah gets greenlit into a film, I'll read it then, so I can get nice and fresh, go watch the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about like 3 years' time.
It'll be a while,
It'll be a while before Messiah comes out, if it does. I hope it does.
I hope it does.
There's been talk of a Dune sort of spin-off like a, series or something like that about I don't know what it could be about goodness me but
a bit more history
anything
I
guess. yeah
because there are some points in the film that I think do kind of lack a little bit, like if you haven't read the book Mentats aren't really explained at any
Mentats
point
are never
in, the film.
In the film if you're interested. Mentats are never explained in the film. No one even says the word Mentat.
No. There's a certain points where Howard's like
where,
looks up and goes
like that.
Someone's coming. It's like, what is it? Kynes turns up. And I want to speak to Kynes.
Yeah,
and he goes, oh, yes, they're here. And it's like, I know why he can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyone else probably doesn't.
Dr. Liet Kynes, who we've completely skipped over in this whole thing.
Well, we have less of an impact in the film.
Orcologist, yes. She's an imperial orcologist.
Yeah.
And she's basically So the Doctor is in charge of seeing the change of Iraq from Harkonnen rule to Atreides rule.
Yes. Which essentially in the film equates to...
being there.
Gets someone on Ornithopter, shows them the worm, and then gets captured and is killed pretty much straight away.
Gets captured, helps Paul and Jessica escape, and then dies.
Yeah. Whereas in the book, it's a bit more than that.
Yeah, yeah.
But ends up just dying anyway.
Max von Sydow, yeah, of course. And...
everyone dies in the book.
Yeah, true. There's a lot of death in the book. Well, then part two, I think, there's a lot of death as well.
Probably.
I think, with quite a few people. I won't say who, but, you know, quite a few of them. And, yeah, a couple of quick notes. The cast of Dune Part 2.
Really good.
Amazing, yeah, Part 1. Oscar Isaac, of course.
Fantastic pick.
We mentioned Stellan, Timothy Chalamet. You know it's pronounced Timotei, apparently.
Is it?
But you can also say Timothy.
I say
Timothy. That's fine.
I've never heard it pronounced Timothy.
Oh. Apparently it's French. So, yeah, Timothy Chalamet, who does a great job as well. The name of the person that plays Jessica escapes me, but I know she does great. And, of course, Batista and Duncan and Jason Momoa and Liette Kynes as well. Everyone does a great job.
Yeah.
It's a great film.
It's a really good film.
It is a really good film. And a good adaptation. I think it changes what's necessary and tightens it up a bit more. And I think that's all you want from an adaptation, is to adapt.
Yeah.
And it does adapt. And it's also a nice replication of the story of Dune as well.
Yeah.
So let's drop Dune Part 2 a rating and then I can move on to
Dune Part 1.
Dune Part 2 is what I've seen. But yeah, Dune Part 1, a rating.
I really enjoyed it. So it's going to get very high for me. I'm going to leave it a bit open because everyone's saying how Dune Part 2 is fantastic, it's great. I don't know if it still is now, but it was the highest rated on IMDb at one point.
Yes.
There's a lot of deleted scenes in part one, so maybe part one might get a bit better than a standard one, possibly. So I'm going to leave it a little bit open. So I'm still going to give it an 8.5, because I still really enjoyed it.
Right, yes.
But I'm just giving it a little bit of a gap. So when I watch part two, and if we ever review part two, I might get like a 9.9, okay. A bit higher up. Still a little bit of a nudge there.
I'm willing to give it a 9.
Okay.
I'm willing to drop it to a 9. I'm willing to say, yeah, this is a great adaptation. Again, I love the first book. Absolutely love it. I love the first book. I know roughly what happens in the rest of the series. I know there's like 7. I know there's like something like 26, 36 books overall.
There's a lot of stuff.
But it's a lot of like companion pieces. Yeah. It's a lot of like lore-focused books.
I think it's a lot of 6 main books.
Six or seven mainline series books.
Two trilogies, essentially.
Yeah.
And then you've got like the rest.
The rest of the books, which is kind of like lore-focused and things like that. And a lot of it's done by Brian Herbert, who's Frank Herbert's son.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the sort of lore and creation and things like that. And so I think I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10 reels. Now, my weekly rec.
Yes, here we are.
Corey, you will know that one of my favourite characters in Dune, well, maybe my favourite Dune character.
Okay.
Do you know my favourite Dune character?
Is it Gurney Halleck?
No, it's not Gurney Halleck.
It's not Gurney Halleck. Is it Duncan Idaho?
No, it's not Duncan Idaho. It's not Fayard. It's not.
It's not Paul.
No, it's not Paul. It's not.
Is it Grandad Leto? Well, I've forgot his name. Leto's dad, bullfighter.
Oh no, it's not the bullfighter. No.
Forgot his name.
It's not the bullfighter.
Paul's granddad.
No, it's not Paul. I know he's got a name. I know he's like.
He has got a name. He's mentioned a bit in the book.
There's
a literally
family tree for both houses.
Yeah, he's barely mentioned in the film. It's like his portrait appears and the bull appears.
Yeah,
and that's
it. Well, no, the bull's head appears.
Bull's head appears. Yeah.
And then there's a picture of him.
Yeah.
There's a picture of him and he is fighting the bull because they say that the Atreides house used to be bullfighters. And you want another cool connection?
Right.
Harkonnen.
Yep.
Means bull.
Nice.
I think Harkonnen is a. You might want to look this up, but okay. I think Harkonnen may be a sort of Nordic or Icelandic, Scandinavian version of sort of to mean bull or something like that.
Finnish surname Harkonnen, which means, what does that mean? Finnish surname, search the web for Harkonnen. Can I find anything that isn't Dune?
Okay, yeah.
So it comes from the Finnish, what's the Finnish name for Harkonnen mean? Northern Europe and ancient, that's also Finland. Great, very useful. What's it mean?
Okay.
It's giving me people, got Wikipedia.
Great.
Can't see him, mate. You can't say him in. We'll say it means bull.
All right.
That
okay.
sounds about That's right.
Well, I mean, I heard. So, well, I mean, I heard so in.
Oh God.
This isn't my rec. Okay. This is an alternate rec. There's a YouTube channel called Alt Swift X, if you've heard of him.
I haven't.
And he does videos on things like Game of Thrones and stuff like that. And he's also in a lot of Doom videos.
Right.
And that fact's from one of those videos. So that's how I know. Wait, hold on. Let me. I don't know if I can.
Are you looking it up now?
All
I'm finding is it's a surname. That's it.
Oh, here we go. I found something. Thank you, sci-fi.com.
Nice.
Who's and the article is aptly named, What's Up With All the Bullfighting Imagery in Dune? it is said that... I'm sorry, here we go. Oh, right, okay. This is what it means. Not only that, but House Harkonnen possibly takes its name from the Finnish Harkonnen. This name may come from the word harka
right.
in Finnish, which means ox.
Okay, that fits.
So I think that fits.
That fits.
That fits. Now, my favourite Dune character is Edric, who is a guild navigator who appears in Dune Messiah.
Okay.
Right? I'm quite a fan of the Space and Guild.
Okay.
I quite like their sort of whole vibe, their whole thing. And my favourite character is Edric because I think he's got a cool look, and he's very interesting. And you don't see the guild navigators from Dune, not in the first book.
No,
I'm sure you hear about them.
Yeah, they're mentioned.
They're
mentioned, and I believe don't know if it's a navigator, but someone from the space guild appears at the party scene.
A guild representative, I think, appears.
Little meeting. It isn't in the film, but it's in the book. With Luwek? What's his name? The smuggler. There's a smuggler in there. I think it's called Luwek or Layek.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. He's in there as well. Don't know why it's in the film. It's a great scene in the book. Love that scene.
So I'm going to recommend Navigators of Dune.
Navigators of Dune.
Which is a book by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. Okay. And a 2016 novel. So pretty
recent.
Yeah, for Dune. And it's part of the Great Schools of Dune series.
Okay.
So basically part of the institutions, so the Imperial House Carino, the Bene Gesserit, and the Spacing Guild. And I'm going to bring Navigators of Dune because it is about the guild navigators. And it's a prequel to the Dune series. And it's also a sequel to The Legends of Dune.
Nice.
Which is about the Butlerian Jihad and the Battle of Corin and things like that. So basically, they're doing trilogies.
Yep.
And Navigator of Dune is basically how the Guild Navigators sort of came to be, and how the Spacing Guild was sort of constructed after the Balerian Jihad and the Bene Gesserit and the Mentats and all that.
Very nice. I'm looking up pictures of it now.
Mm. The front picture is a picture of a junction, which is a Spacing Guild base, basically.
Nice.
And you'll see there's a navigator in that little...
Yep.
In there.
There's a picture of him in a tank.
Very nice. A navigator in a tank.
That's just a drawing of what looks like Dune 1984, but okay.
Oh, I think I found the same thing. There's the guy. There's Edric. But yeah, I'm going to give Navigators of Dune a 8.
Nice.
It's a good book. Quite
that's
like
strong.
It. And that's for my favourite Dune character, Edric the Guild Navigator. So thank you very much for watching and listening to our review of Dune Part 1. Maybe Dune Part 2 review coming up in a bit, so hopefully. And it's a goodbye from me. Goodbye. And a goodbye from Corey.
Goodbye.